Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you guys about betonline.ag. It's the final home stretch before the basketball playoffs. It's a duel in the East for spots 2 through 8. In the West, teams 6 through 9 are all separated by just one game. New Orleans, Phoenix, Sacramento, Los Angeles, they're all battling it out to avoid that play-in and make it to the playoffs. We have got you covered with all the odds, props, promos, and parlays, and you can pick up a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit at BetOnline using the link in the description to this episode using our promo code BLEAV, BLEAV. BetOnline, where the game starts. Hello.
Hey, Kyle. How you doing, bud?
I am doing very well today. How are you?
I'm great. It's a beautiful day in the Tar Heel State.
It's always beautiful in the Tar Heel State. Glad that I'm glad that you are having a great day. How was the Final Four?
Well, I'll break it down. I can break down the good, the bad, and the ugly for you, and hopefully your listeners will enjoy it. We'll start with the good. Obviously, being there, it's a spectacle. I think that if you have your squad in the Final Four, go find a way, maneuver your finances. It's a gathering of people that want to be there, that you haven't probably seen in several years. For me, some people in decades, like 20 years ago. So the gathering itself was incredible. The feeling that you belong is incredible, that you're part of this elite event was something that I don't think I'll experience again, likely. I mean, the odds are against us to make another Final Four. Maybe that happens in my 60s or 50s, but you never know. Obviously, anything can happen. But so that's really the good. I would say the bad, from a Wolfpack perspective, just couldn't hit the ocean from the beach, especially in the second half. I think I don't know what the percentages were. I mean, I can't imagine we shot more than 28% to 32%. I mean, that's just not going to cut it, right? We had chances, Kyle. We cut the lead to 3 with 105 left in the first half, gave up a 3 with probably under 45 seconds in the first half, and then turned it over on our final possession. And they came out in the second half with 2 straight 3-point shots. I didn't think Purdue looked that good. I really thought we did a great job on Edie. I think Edie had 20. To me, that is a win, a massive win, to only have him place 20 on the stat line. I would say more bad would be the stadium, Kyle, and I think you can make the argument for other football stadiums. It's not meant to be. This is not a place to watch basketball. You have to have an elite seat to have a great view of the Final Four. So we're never going to go back to arenas. The spectacle is too large. To their credit, I think the stadium was probably, I would say, 89-92% full. So that does warrant a 66,000-seat stadium for this event. You know, I would guess that there was probably 60 to 61K there. But, you know, listen, I wasn't going to miss it. I was not going to miss it, and I'm glad I went.
Yeah, it's the first time in 41 years that NC State happened to get there, and I'm just glad that you made the time to make that a reality, because it is, doing it in the football stadiums is an interesting experience. Cause when I got to go to one, it was like all the way in the upper deck, and it was like, oh my gosh, they're so far away. And the court is way smaller than you think it is when you compare it to an NFL size field, in which they have curtains dropped down. Did they have the same thing out in Phoenix where like they drop curtains down for like 2/3 of what would be the football stadium and just make it seem like there's nothing back there? Or was it like,
no
they didn't do that.
No.
No, and I assume for my sake that was because it was the COVID year that they cut off half the arena basically, because they only were putting, I think, 20,000 people in the stadium. But it's crazy to think about just how far away from the action you would be if you're on the opposite end of the floor of the arena while you have a game going on right at center court, and center court is basically from like 40 yard line to 45 yard line on what would be a football stadium.
Kyle, I was behind the goal, behind the NC State student section, and I couldn't see action on the other side of the goal. I mean, I could see, and I was 100 level, by the way. Mm-hmm. You have to be mid court, 100 level in these type of stadiums. I can't speak for what it's like to be at the Superdome in that situation, or perhaps the Detroit Lions Stadium, the Colts Stadium, but the Cardinals Stadium was atrocious for viewing unless you had the premium seats. And it's crazy, the premium seats really never dropped. I mean, they were still on Ticketmaster, StubHub, whatever source you want to go for tickets, for about $5,000 per. So pricing out probably 98% of the market to have a great seat. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, again, listen, you know, I wasn't there for the perfect view. I was there to, you know, see the spectacle unfold. Met a lot of great people. Met Drew Brees, really nice guy. Walked right by Charles Barkley, took a picture with one of my favorite sports announcers of all time, Tim Brando. John Fanta, great announcer, great guy that works a lot of Big East. Ran into him. We have a mutual friend. So, had a great time. I mean, just a phenomenal event, spectacle. But yeah, from a seating perspective, prepare to be disappointed if you go to a Final Four unless you're 100 level midcourt.
Okay, so let's talk about the games themselves. NC State, obviously the Cinderella run came to an end against Purdue, but damn if they didn't give it a good run. And then, of course, you had UConn just running the table all the way through to the championship. Did you stick around for the second game after NC State?
I did.
Okay.
I watched UConn through halftime and a little bit after, just because of traffic. Tough traffic, Kyle. Just too much to overcome, and just didn't want to deal with it. It took from the airport area, which is where my hotel was, to get to the game, approximately 80 to 90 minutes. The mileage was about 20, right? Now, everybody leaving at the same time, or at least three quarters, I think you can increase that to 2 hours plus. Wasn't willing to do that. Very tired, long travel day. So I watched, I think we left at maybe the 16-minute mark of the second half. I mean, it was a great first half. Alabama shot the lights out, you know, the three ball. I think at one point Alabama was 7 for 8 from downtown. That was their only hope, was to shoot 75% from downtown to beat this UConn team. But, you know, I look at this UConn team and, you know, obviously there are not many holes, but, you know, there's some teams out there. If you look at the past, like some of the Gator teams that won it in 06, 07, and even the Carolina 09 team, I think they're better than this UConn team. But credit to Hurley and his kids, man, they just ran through everybody with ease. And I just don't see that dominant, like, superstar. They're all just really good. You know, they're all really good college players. And I think there will be a couple of these guys that will probably play in the pros with ease. So, yeah, I mean, credit to UConn. I you know, listen, I had Purdue over UConn to win the national championship in my big one. It was close to be there. I was right in there, Kyle. I was a major pot, and I would have won it. Unfortunately, I will go from the first place prize to fourth, which gives you nothing. But I had a great time. It was just a fun 2 weeks of hoops and being a part of the NC State train and watching Purdue, as the guy that had Purdue over UConn, to have a chance to win several thousand dollars. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, Razor, you know you're the gambling guy. You got a hedge with a nice little UConn money line
bet. Well, let's just say that happened. That did happen. That was a gift, I think. Like, my fear was that UConn would be about maybe 4.25 on the money line. Kyle, I got it when it opened up. UConn opened at 5. I got it at 280. I just threw a big play on UConn straight up, and that really never was in doubt. I mean, you can make an argument that Edie was just playing lights out towards the middle of the first half, right, where they had little to no answer, but it just felt like it was never in doubt. I noticed that Edie, I don't know if you noticed this and your listeners, I thought Edie was gassed really early, and I've never seen Edie look that gassed before. I think he was playing so hard on both ends of the floor. He was a disaster by the 5-minute mark, or at least the under 4 timeout in the first half. He was done. I'm like, this game's over. This guy is toast. And he should be, because he plays 38 to 40 minutes every game. And I think it has to take a toll on you at some point. The adrenaline, the fatigue, I just knew it. I just saw it on TV, and I also bet it live. When I saw that, when UConn got a little bit of a lead, I think it was maybe 5 or 4, you still could get a good price on UConn under $3. So I kept pounding it, knowing that I was going to lose, you know, the bracket. So yes, I was fine. It was a good night on Monday.
Yeah, I saw Draymond Green was getting some flack for kind of saying the same type of thing, that he kind of just ran out of gas a little bit towards the end. And I felt like Edie, I know the 37 and 10 looked good, but obviously we all saw, like, yeah, the 37 and 10 wasn't doing as much. One thing that I thought was interesting is they were doing film breakdown and showing that Edie was constantly, when he was going to the post-ups, always going to his right. They were pressuring him super hard to the right, and he just kept trying to shoot hook shots to the right every time, where they were giving him the left if he had turned back and dribbled up, but they kind of knew that wasn't the move he was going for. And, you know, even though it was 37 and 10, the whole offense was just, it's Edie or it's nothing. And the rest of the team had like 23 points. So I'm with you. I think that by about 12 minutes left in the game, there wasn't much left for him. But I still felt like Edie had a very good game. Even as you say, he was gassed. I think UConn did a great job of just knowing his tendencies and pressuring him to go right. Pressuring him to cut off going right every time, and he just kept trying it. And I'm with you on the fact that it looked like by about 12 minutes left in the game, there wasn't much left. And by that point, if you're watching the highlights on ESPN, they just kind of skip from showing baskets to, hey, now we're celebrating the championship, because there was nothing interesting that happened in the last 12 minutes.
So here's my take on that. I agree with you a lot on a lot of your points. I saw it much earlier. I saw the Edie fatigue transpire early on, late first half. What I think they did in the second half, and only Coach Hurley can probably reveal this, I felt like they just said, you know what, this guy's toast. Let's give him his points. You look at the last 7 baskets from Edie, you and I can make those shots. I mean, they were point blank. No one defended him, I think, towards the end of the game when the game was already out of hand. But they just really crunched down on the guards. They would not allow a 3-point shot from any of those trio of guards. So I feel like the strategy shifted to let Edie eat. Let him have 42 points, 39 points. It doesn't matter. If we control the guard play at the perimeter, these guys have no chance. Let's just guard 4 out of these 5 guys to the best of our ability. And if we maintain a 3-possession game, it's over. They're not going to shoot threes. I felt like all of the focus started to shift on all of their guard play. And it worked. I mean, it was just – look at the guards. I'd love to see how many points all of Purdue's guards scored from the 10-minute mark of the second half onwards. It has to be extremely low, because Edie scored most of the points, and that was fine. You can give up 2s if you're up by – 9 or 11 at one point, and you keep scoring. It didn't matter. You just couldn't give up 3s to give Purdue any hope. So yeah, yet again, a great plan by probably the best coach right now in America, Coach Hurley, and an easy UConn championship. And I just cannot believe, if you took UConn against the spread and NC State money line over the last 3 weeks, Kyle, you are probably buying a new house.
That's crazy to think about. That's crazy to think about UConn every single time, not only winning, but covering the spread in almost every single game that they're playing, no matter how high you set the spread, whether it was first round games against, I think it was it Wagner or something they were playing, all the way down to the championship, they were winning by double digits every single time. And I think you're spot on about Hurley. And I didn't see that coming for Hurley. Obviously, he had done a great job at Rhode Island, and that's where everyone first knew Hurley from and all that. But I couldn't have envisioned him being in the NIL and the transfer portal era that he would come and take everyone's lunch. And now all of a sudden, UConn is once again this dynastic program, which the one thing I thought was funny is that they had him and Calhoun down on the floor afterwards and Kevin Ollie nowhere to be seen. I know he's coaching the Brooklyn Nets right now. He's like the interim head coach of the Nets, but they do not like that guy at UConn. he won a championship at UConn and he is not welcome back in the same way
yeah,
they're going to
yeah.
treat Calhoun.
Yeah, the Ollie thing is puzzling, but you know, there's more than meets the eye there. He may have burned some bridges that you and I wouldn't know about. And I mean, he had a magical run, right? To win that tournament. I want to say UConn was an 8 seed, maybe. I can't remember. I think that win over Kentucky, Kentucky's team, was that Kentucky they beat in the national championship? And I believe UConn was an 8 or 9. It was just an incredible run by Ollie. But yeah, that seems like he has been kind of driven away from the UConn history and the UConn fraternity in some ways. It's kind of sad to see.
Yeah, I know there was a whole lawsuit on the way out the door because he was fighting for money and stuff like that. Yeah, it was Kentucky, which I'd forgotten that Kentucky was in the championship game in 2014, because that would mean they went championship 2012, runner up 2014, final four 2015. Like, they had a damn good run in there. But I think UConn was a 7 that year. Let me see. I don't remember which was which there. Let's see. Yeah, they were a 7 seed. UConn was
seven
a seven.
Okay. So yeah, they were a low single digit seed, and that's a pretty remarkable run by Ollie, but doesn't matter now because they have their guy, and it's a UConn coronation, right? As Zion Eagle would say, and I don't know who's going to stop this train. It seems to be the betting favorite as we go into late November is Duke to win the national championship, the number one recruiting class coming in. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see what happens from this point going forward there. A crescendo of a championship in the men's tournament that got immediately overshadowed by John Calipari popping out of Kentucky and heading to Arkansas, which obviously no one saw coming, but just the whole, my favorite thing about that is the whole joke that this all started because SMU moved to the ACC and they wanted Enfield from USC, which then led to Musselman leaving Arkansas for USC, which now leads to Calipari leaving Kentucky for Arkansas, and might lead to Scott Drew leaving Baylor for Kentucky, which at the time of recording, the last thing I saw is that he's been offered the job and a decision's going to come today. We don't actually know whether Drew is the coach at Baylor yet, or is leaving Baylor to go to Kentucky. But what did you make of this whole crazy coaching saga of the last 48 to 72 hours?
I don't think anything can surprise you anymore. When I heard Calipari to Fayetteville, I just didn't blink. I just was like, sure, why not? There's no loyalty from the fan base much anymore. And at some time, there's no loyalty from the coaches and definitely no loyalty to the players in this world we live in. So if you're Calipari, yeah, I mean, why not? I mean, obviously, Fayetteville, Arkansas hasn't really been on the map for a while. They did make an Elite Eight, I believe, last year or the year before. So this is not a terrible landing spot. But I know he's close with, I believe, the Tyson owner, who's an Arkansas grad, Tyson Farms, everybody knows, or Purdue, whatever. I think it's Tyson
yeah,
Farms,
yeah,
who has
it is.
Yeah, the chick. I mean, so there's a business relationship there, a friendship there that makes a lot of sense. Maybe there's, hey, I'm going to be able to, you know, play Kentucky for several years and probably finish out my career in the SEC. Why not? And I just don't have a great take on it, Kyle. It's just like, nothing, does anything surprise you anymore at this point? Like, I mean, the only thing that would surprise me is if locally down the street, we saw Shire to Carolina, Davis to Duke, or a big time transfer in the portal go from Carolina to Duke, Duke Carolina. Other than that, I just don't see anything that really surprises me with very little loyalty that with the NIL and just simply money in general. I mean, I don't know where this money comes from, where you can just buy out millions and millions of dollars in contract while there's so many people in this country. And I don't want to get into socioeconomic and political stuff, but like, where, what kind of country do we live in where buyouts are just the norm? This is, I mean, so much money that is driven away from these schools. And I just don't even care anymore at this point. There's no loyalty. And as far as Calipari goes, if you're a Kentucky fan, I think you could almost say shame on you, because if you look at the overall resume, look at NC State, what I would have given to have a run that Calipari had over this decade, I would have given a lot. So yeah, sure, he definitely disappointed at times. There's no doubt. You can't lose to Oakland. You can't lose to St. Peter's. But sure, he gave you a couple Final Fours, a national title, a couple national championship appearances. It wasn't that rough, Kentucky. So good luck with your next hire. I hope Drew works out. It probably will be Drew. I'm sure it will be. You have to leave Baylor for Kentucky. The tradition behind UK basketball is it's top five, and I feel like you did what you had to do at Baylor. You won a national championship in Waco, Texas. It's not getting better, Coach Drew. You have to take this UK job.
You said that there's not much that would surprise you anymore, and I think this is the bar that I would put down for surprising, because the Arkansas is not perceived as that kind of job. In fairness to Musselman, not only did he make one Elite Eight, he made the Elite Eight in back-to-back seasons.
Yeah,
21 and 22. And I just, this is one that I could not have fathomed, in part because, and this is the sneaky part of all of this, Calipari's 65 years old. Like, this is not a forever type of job for him or for Arkansas. And I don't understand the motivation beyond just not wanting to work at Kentucky anymore. And I didn't realize things had gotten so bad at Kentucky. We made the joke that if Kentucky lost to Oakland, it was going to be an all-timer of a sports radio day in Lexington, Kentucky, for people calling in and you know, whatever sports radio they do. And that's just because fans are going to be so pissed at him, and also he's going to continue to be their coach because they are married to each other for what seemed like a lifetime contract. Calipari was going to retire at that job. And the fact that it went from Calipari is coming back next year because they're not going to pay that buyout, which in fairness, I think to your point about the socioeconomics of buyouts, like the lack of systems and structures in college sports that we've become accustomed to in professional sports between salary caps, between contract negotiations, those things that we've become accustomed to don't exist anymore. And what's interesting is that in a post-pandemic world, the boosters of these schools now have surpluses of disposable income that they didn't previously have prior to 2020. And that again relates to the socioeconomics of the sport, and people are making, or the socioeconomics of America in general, but more specifically to the sport, where billionaire heir to the Tyson chicken farm can spend his family's fortune trying to make a basketball team good by committing $6 million per year in NIL and a base salary of $7.5 million plus incentives to John Calipari. And it's a good deal potentially business-wise, because the money you invest now might lead to some profit for the Arkansas coaching job. But to the point about Calipari jumping ship in that way, I don't see the motivation for him to make that jump, because he's not making as much money in base salary as he originally was. He's leaving the program that, granted, wasn't a program that he like built from scratch or whatever. Like, his name's never going to be on that court. It's already Rupp Arena. They had a long history of success before you. They look at this differently because of the program and its storied history. If this were a case like Baylor, where built the program from nothing and 10 years later you're competing for a championship, or 20 years later you've done what Drew does, I understand the difficulty of walking away from that job. But if it's Calipari, who, yes, was in the job longer than Tubby Smith and longer than Rick Pitino and all these people that have stopped off at Kentucky and had just as much success as a lot of those people, it's still not, it's not the same. It's not that they don't have the same relationship that Calipari would have had with the school otherwise, but when he was winning a whole bunch and going to the finals in winning the finals in 2012, going to the finals in 14, putting together the perfect season in 2015 until they lost to Wisconsin and Kaminsky and all those guys, like when they were going through all that, yeah, it was so much easier to commit the lifetime contract and say he'll be able to figure it out. And just, I'm surprised that it only took 5 years for all those good graces to get burned. It took like 5 to 6 years for all the goodwill that he built up to disappear.
Again, I think you just made some really articulate points. I get it. But in the world of this that we live in, nothing surprises me. Listen, he's going to go into Fayetteville as a god. They're going to want him. They haven't had a coach. I think Musselman's a great coach. Two Elite Eights in a row is unprecedented for Arkansas. The last time they did that was 94-95, reaching the national championship back-to-back years, winning it in 94, losing to UCLA in 95. But other than that, it's a dark history for Arkansas in between 95 and 21. And I think when you're Calipari and you look at that and you say, hey, I don't need any money the rest of my life. I'm set. My grandkids are set. Let's stay in the SEC. Let's get out of this town where they want to cut my head off. And let's just kind of wrap it up and let's just shock the world and win an SEC championship and just stick it to UK. I buy into that. I get it. I think it's the right move for Calipari to land in Fayetteville, Arkansas, Columbia, South Carolina, places like that where you have a chance to win because there is a building block in the last few years. So I look at it like that. Again, nothing surprises me, but I want to shift gears and just throw out some breaking news that has just hit the wire on your podcast, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go
Buffalo
ahead.
Bills running back. Yeah, Buffalo Bills former running back and alleged murderer O.J. Simpson is dead. He is dead. He has died. O.J. Simpson has passed away. So that just came through text message from a variety of friends of mine. So breaking news on your podcast, Kyle. It's the juice is no longer loose.
Yeah, I saw that while we were recording and I was like, wonder how we're gonna go about this, because I'm sure everyone's gonna be very polite about this.
Yeah, well, you have me on the podcast as a Bills guy, right? So that's kind of warranting the breaking news. We'll give him the one positive thing about OJ. Let's say he was a great running back for Buffalo Bills, right? So
sure,
that's what you can say positive.
Not necessarily for our sake, like this is just a stupid podcast or whatever, and we can go ahead and make the jokes, but I'm just curious what people with more media credibility are going to do with this whole situation, because I had an old history teacher that made a great point that, you know, you can draw a line of demarcation between the O.J. Simpson trial in the 1990s and the beginning of the fall of Western civilization in America, and specifically American civilization, and make some points that kind of outline this in multiple factors. But this is a pop culture moment that sparked the pop culture of the last 20 to 25 years. And it begins with the O.J. Simpson trial and everything that happened after that. It's just, again,
it's the most polarizing moment that I can remember. You probably were not born.
I was not, but I have watched the OJ in America documentary.
Yeah, and that was a great one. And I watched the Chase live from a hotel in 1994, the summer of 94. It was June 94. The Knicks were playing the Rockets in the NBA Finals. It was just a great moment as a Knicks fan. You know, basically one of the few championship opportunities that we've had, last one in 99, but credit to the Knicks, by the way, clinching a playoff berth last night. But it's a polarizing event. I'll be pretty confident and say that man is had a very lucky life after 1994. Let's just say that he got away with something. It's sad, and But it's over. OJ is gone. He's probably now, you know, all the Twitter jokes and everything are probably likely coming to an end because this guy is no longer with us.
Yeah, and he had a pretty lucky life afterwards, at least until the unlucky part where he did end up having to go to jail again. But
yeah,
it's still, to think that it's 40, or not 40, the fact that it's 30 years later, because you said it was June of 1994, and we're coming up on the 30th anniversary of the O.J. Simpson chase, which there's another really good documentary that's called June 14th, 1994, which details how, like, that whole day in sports was crazy because it was like,
yes, it was a great documentary. What a crazy day, huh?
Wow. Yeah, it was like Arnold Palmer plays his last U.S. Open or like last professional golf tournament. And then I think there's something with Ken Griffey Jr. or something like that. And then
the Knicks
finals.
Yep.
Yeah, it's just the whole thing is really interesting. And just to follow how you get from there to now. So just to talk about some of those points, like it's this idea that is one of the most polarizing events in American history along racial lines, especially in 1990s America. The documentary does a great job of outlining that part of it. The part that they kind of skip over is the reality TV connection and the Kardashian aspect to it and how pop culture kind of evolves from that. And that leads to Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And you see kind of the evolution of that pop culture that comes somehow from a murder trial. And you have all of the distrust of court systems that comes from the O.J. Simpson trial, how wealth and privilege can help you get off in a lot of these cases. There's so many interesting layers to this story. And of course, that's the thing that is going to get talked about first and foremost. I know people are going to do the thing where, like, when Richard Nixon died, the first thing they wrote in his obituary was opened up trade with China. And I know they're going to do the thing where they talk about his football career and his broadcasting career and mention Naked Gun and do all that stuff. But this is, you know, this is the part of the story that I'm sure everyone is going to, I'm being sarcastic when I say this, I know everyone is going to do a perfect job of discussing and acknowledging as O.J. Simpson dies. And this is the last time we're probably going to talk about him for a while.
And it should be the last time we talk about him for a while. Let's just say that, right? Don't need to glamorize this scenario any longer. Yeah.
Well, they'll probably talk about it again when the 30th anniversary comes up in June.
Yes, yes. Yes, that's fair. I understand that. Yeah. But other than that, boy, we're going to put it to bed, Kyle. Just like we're putting to bed the NCAA tournament. Kind of sad, huh?
Yeah, this is our last episode for a good portion of the year, at least until we get really rolling with baseball season. So now that all is said and done, Razor, this is year four of us coming together and doing all these shows. What do you make of the season at large here?
Well, I had a great time. Always love coming on to podcasts, especially yours. Have a chance to, excited to be on a buddy of mine's podcast this weekend, Tyler Hansborough, Carolina legend. Him and I play pickleball on a daily basis together. We'll go over Wolfpack season. We'll wrap that up on Sunday. And I think it's just one of those things that, you know, for me, it was a magical year. I should say it was not a magical year. It was a magical 3 weeks because in the winter months, it was awful watching NC State basketball play. Disappointing Buffalo Bills ending in the semifinals of the AFC. Just gruesome ending there. It just seems like Kansas City owns us. And then, of course, now we need a wide receiver, Kyle. If you're available, contact the guys in Orchard Park because we are I don't know. I don't like our depth chart right now, wide receiver. Hopefully we do something sneaky here in the spring and find us a wide receiver one. I don't think Curtis Samuel is the answer. So it's always great. You know, and you know, for me as a gambler, it's time to slow down. A little bit of tennis action, very little MLB. MLB, I say this every year to my friends, if you're betting heavy April, May, June MLB, boy, I mean, you are really rolling the dice. It's tough. That's a tough one to bet. But I do think it's one of the easier sports to bet in the months of August and September when teams tank leading up to the playoffs. You know, the likes of the Oakland Athletics, the Chicago White Sox, these teams are just going to throw it in as we approach the August and early September months. It seems like one of the easier easier sports to gamble at the end. So keep that in mind. But yeah, Kyle, I mean, you and I will probably go a little bit radio silent here for several months. Not a whole lot to talk about on my end. I'm not an NBA guy, so can't provide my feedback there. But I always appreciate you inviting me. Love what you do. Continue to be great at what you do. And I look forward to hopefully reconnecting at the end of the summer.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being one of our most consistent and best friends of the show. Thank you, as always, Razor, for every piece of expertise and analysis, and of course, the time that you've just given to this podcast, especially over the last couple of years. It is very much appreciated, as always, and we are so grateful for you being one of the friends of this show.
Hey, I'm always a friend, Kyle. Always a friend of your show. Don't ever let anyone tell you else otherwise. But yeah, hey, good luck with the rest of the summer, everyone listening. If you're betting, good luck in the NBA, NHL. Even if you bet golf and tennis, it's Masters Week. Good luck for those betting on the Masters. And all the best to you, Kyle. I appreciate it.